From Oregon to Virginia, Iowa to Vermont, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the national debt has hit a record $32 trillion. David Ditch of the Heritage Foundation is here to discuss the need to get federal spending under control. With a growing Hunter Biden scandal and renewed concerns over his age, President Joe Biden has had a rough week. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Independence Day weekend is the perfect time to talk about restoring constitutional government. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Devin Watkins of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And the aborted insurrection against Russian President Vladimir Putin thrust Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko into the international spotlight. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College examines their relationship on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. $32 trillion. That is the size of the national debt, and it is growing rapidly. To discuss the impact, we turn to David Ditch. He is a senior policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. David, welcome to American Radio Journal. David, we all know the federal government is running a massive budget deficit. They have a tremendous amount of borrowing that has taken place really over decades. What is the actual budget deficit number now?
What they call the gross federal debt, which is all of the accumulated deficits that have happened over the course of American history, that recently hit $32 trillion. Now, obviously, that's an amount of money that no one can actually comprehend. But if you were to boil that down and look at what the share is for every household in the country, that would be about $245,000 per household.
So if we were to pay off the federal debt, my household, your household, everybody else would have to come up with $245,000 to make that go away right now?
That is correct.
And looking at that federal debt, there was a time in our history where we didn't have that. And of course, in times of war, particularly the world wars, obviously that debt and deficit went up. Historically speaking, are we at relatively an all-time high?
In terms of during peacetime, absolutely. And it isn't even close. The reason why it has jumped so rapidly over the last few years is that from the onset of the COVID pandemic, Congress just went hog wild spending on everything they could because they thought that essentially no one was paying attention. To an extent, maybe they were right. This I find absolutely incredible. In the first 215 years of America, the national debt went up to $7 trillion, 215 years. Then, within a matter of 27 months, starting in March of 2020, we added an additional $7 trillion. So, just to give you a scale of what an incredible amount of money went out the door.
We recently went through a situation where there was a deal made in terms of raising the debt limit, and supposedly there was to be some spending reductions. As you look at it, and as you study the federal budget day by day here, David, are we really looking at any actual reduction in spending here as a result of that deal?
The deal that they call the Fiscal Responsibility Act, I feel like, is rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. They supposedly reduce a small portion of the federal budget, what they call discretionary spending. The reality is they actually used about $50 billion in budget gimmicks that they will then backfill up and ultimately will slightly increase the amount of spending from last year. And even, unfortunately, legislation that's being put through the House of Representatives that claims to be better, that claims to be more responsible, they have even more gimmicks and do even more backfilling. And the result is nobody seems to be willing to make any hard decisions to prioritize public resources at all. And that means that spending is going to keep chugging along.
Was spending not supposed to remain relatively level in the coming fiscal year as a part of that deal?
In theory, there are limits that have been put in place on future sessions of Congress. The problem is we can't count on that happening. So, for example, back in 2011, the Obama administration and congressional Republicans hammered out a deal that eventually led to spending caps. In the early years, they played reasonably close to the vest on the spending levels. But as time went on, they started increasing the spending more and more and more. And then by the end of a decade, the spending levels were actually higher than they would have been if nothing had happened in the first place. They increased them that rapidly. Whereas if we make reforms to, if we make major long-term reforms to existing programs, those reforms are much harder and much less likely to be undone in the future.
If you listen to the left, David, looking back on this recent deal that was struck, they would have you believe that the sky is falling, there have been draconian cuts, the world is going to come to an end. I'm gathering from what you're saying that that's not really the case here.
That is not the case by any way you want to measure it. Federal spending is still dramatically higher than it was before the pandemic. And again, the spending at issue is only about 30% of what the federal government actually pumps out every year. You still have, in addition to that, we're spending huge amount of money and rapidly growing amount of money on, you know, covering the interest on the national debt. And then there's another rapidly growing amount of money that goes to support programs like Social Security and Medicare, both programs, by the way, that are on pace to go bankrupt not 20 or 30 years down the line, but within about the next 10 years, unless something is done.
And taking a look at all of this spending, all of the deficits, the mounting federal debt that you've pointed out here, David, what impact is that having on inflation? The Federal Reserve has been trying to ratchet up interest rates to get inflation under control. We have moved off by a couple of points, but still way above anybody's target for inflation. What impact is all this spending and debt having on that effort?
And I mentioned a couple months ago, the insane amount of money that the federal government was spending during the pandemic, so much of which was wasted, so much of it was lost to fraud. That was one of the driving forces behind the inflation that started bubbling up in 2021 and really took off last year. And unfortunately, because we have what are called structural deficits, that is to say, you know, the expectation, unless something changes, we have high deficits every single year. The higher the deficits, the more inflationary pressure there is. And in turn, the Federal Reserve tends to react to that by increasing interest rates. When you're increasing interest rates, that means it's a lot more expensive for families, especially younger families, to buy a new home, to finance it with a mortgage. If you want to start a business, it's harder to get an affordable business loan. That has both short and long-term effects on the economy, on growth, on the opportunity that we take for granted as Americans. That's the American dream. And the more that the federal government pushes aside the opportunity for us to decide how we use our hard-earned dollars, the more we're losing that American dream.
Well, this, of course, is a subject we will continue to keep an eye on. We have been talking with David Ditch. David is a senior policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. He keeps an eye on the federal budget, which is, I suppose, not too difficult, David. It's rather large. Tell us a little bit about the Heritage Foundation. And also, you've recently written on this subject. Where can folks go to read more?
The Heritage Foundation recently celebrated its 50th anniversary. And you can find the research by myself and my colleagues at heritage.org.
David Ditch of the Heritage Foundation. David, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Been an interesting week in Washington, D.C. A lot of controversy swirling around President Biden. We're going to talk about that. Also, a couple of key U.S. Senate races. Scott, good to have you here.
Well, it's great to be back, Loman. Thank you.
Joe Biden has been in the news, presidents always are, but he's been in the news a lot this past week for not very good reasons between the Hunter Biden scandal starting to metastasize throughout the system, even the mainstream media starting to cover it a bit, Scott, and his stumbles and bumbles. What impact do you see this having on the 2024 presidential race?
When you look at President Biden, people remember him as sort of lunchbox Joe, easygoing, but you can tell that the media is starting to ask legitimate questions at the White House press briefings. And when they have a chance to directly confront him, which is few and far between, they've been able to get underneath his skin. And now he's starting to sort of lash out at them in a way that not a lot of Americans are used to seeing President Biden behave. And I think that the really interesting thing here is wait until like the real scrutiny of a presidential race gets going and more information comes out about Hunter Biden and the millions of dollars that the Biden family received and didn't pay taxes on. And so I think that with President Biden generally just acting like an old cantankerous man, there's going to be sort of this perception, and presidential races are very much a race of personalities. And right now I think that Biden's personality is struggling.
Taking a look at the differences between President Biden and Donald Trump here, Scott, Donald Trump is not really all that much younger than Joe Biden, but there does appear to be quite a difference in vitality between the two. Do you see that as well?
Well, we all see it because President Trump's been out there swinging the golf club in a big way. He's a big hitter, right? And I think when you look at sort of the feebleness of Joe Biden, there's a pretty big contrast. I don't think there's really any question on who would win a wrestling match between the two of them. But President Trump gets along really well with his supporters. He enjoys the back and forth with the media, and he doesn't have that same daily pressure that President Biden is facing due to the investigations related to his son. And I think that Biden is very, very defensive, while President Trump sort of relishes the opportunity to get in a back and forth with the media, whether it's related to his indictments or just related to his presidential campaign and fighting for the Republican nomination once again. So I think the contrast between them is pretty much night and day, even though they're both not that far apart in age.
Yeah, with President Trump, it seems like every time there's an indictment or a court case that goes against him, his support goes up. Yet with President Biden, what we're seeing is him looking increasingly frail and increasingly not handling the scrutiny very well. Of course, he stayed in the basement the whole 2020 campaign. Do you think there's an opening yet, Scott, for another candidate on the Democrat side, or are the Democrats pretty much stuck with Biden no matter what happens?
Well, RFK is out there, and the Democrats are going to have to figure out, is Joe Biden the best chance that they have to maintain the White House? I'm sure that the loyalists behind President Biden want him and believe in him and think that he deserves to have a second term. But there is, I think, a sort of a concern from many on the left that perhaps Kamala or Gavin Newsom would be a better nominee. And then you also have the fact that RFK is out there and is challenging Biden for the nomination right now. And RFK's got a pretty good chance in New Hampshire, if you ask me.
Let's take a look now at a couple of U.S. Senate races. We have a third, of course, of the United States Senate up for election in 2024. Montana, Scott, Montana is a bright red state represented in the U.S. Senate by a Democrat. There's been some movement in that regard this past week. Can you bring us up to date?
The interesting thing here, Loman, is that the NRSC, the National Republican Senatorial Committee, its chairman is Steve Daines. And he's the other senator from Montana. He's a Republican. And he wants to do everything in his power to defeat John Tester. And so what we have here this week was an announcement from the NRSC's recruit for this race, a guy named Tim Sheehy, Navy SEAL, businessman, very, very wealthy guy, pretty young. And I think that a lot of people in Washington sort of view this as Steve Daines' top recruit for 2024. So him announcing this week was big. He received the endorsement of several senators, including Tom Cotton and Marsha Blackburn and Steve Daines. But on the other hand, you do have a conservative warrior named Matt Rosendale, who has been, according to reports, indicating that he also plans to run for that Senate race. Rosendale lost a close race 5 years ago to John Tester for that Senate race, but then he was elected in statewide office for the at-large seat in Montana. And Rosendale has won statewide five times throughout his career. He's a former state auditor. And so after redistricting, Rosendale had to split Montana with Ryan Zinke. Now they have two congressional seats, but it doesn't take away the fact that Rosendale has proven that he can win statewide. We all know that Tester is a really, really strong candidate. There's no getting around that. He's one of the Democrats' so-called moderates, right? But when you unpack the voting record of people like Tester, you're going to know he's the deciding vote when it came to the pistol brace Biden rule. He's the deciding vote when it comes to the Inflation Reduction Act. And we can say that in all the competitive races.
Scott, in Arizona, Kristen Sinema is the incumbent U.S. senator elected as a Democrat, but she switched and became an independent, and that seat is up for election next year. What do you see developing in Arizona?
It's going to be a big question on how Sinema proceeds as an independent or if she decides to cash it in. She's sort of been in the state legislature, served in the United States Senate as the Democrat equivalent of a maverick trying to fit the mold of John McCain in some ways. But Ruben Gallego is another U.S. representative from Arizona. And so Nancy Pelosi is doing this fundraiser, which creates a lot of conflict, I think, within the Democrat donor class. On the other side of the aisle, Republicans don't know who the top-tier candidates are going to be yet. A lot of folks think Carrie Lake might get in. We all remember her running a very, very close race for Arizona governor last cycle. And the nominee who ran against Mark Kelly last cycle was a guy named Blake Masters. I think there's public reports that Masters is also weighing his options on whether or not to give it another shot.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Well, Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C., clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll check in with you next week. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Just in time for our Independence Day celebration, the Competitive Enterprise Institute has launched its Constitutional Restoration Project. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine learns more from CEI's Devin Watkins.
It is just about the 4th of July. Happy Independence Day to you out there. And that time of year has me thinking about things that don't work in our government, the big kinds of reforms that are needed. I mean, what else is the 4th of July about except those two things, making big changes when government isn't working? And that's what we're going to take a close look at today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Devin Watkins. He's an attorney at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and he's one of the co-authors of a new report that CEI has published. Find it online at cei.org. Constitutional Restoration is the title of the report. Devin joins us now on the phone. Devin, thanks for taking some time with us.
I'm glad to be here.
This is a big picture kind of thing. How to rebuild the separation of powers is the subtitle here. We'll get into a couple of specifics, but first, tell me, Devin, just like this is looking at kind of the whole encompassing federal behemoth and the ways in which the government really should be put back into the box that we designed for it.
Yes, and this takes an important step in that direction. This may not be entirely there, but it does make improvements in returning the power back to Congress rather than being in the executive branch to make the rules under which we live, which are a very important step to take.
One of the things that you talk about in here is the fact that the Federal Trade Commission has won every case in the last 25 years that it's brought before its own administrative judges. Okay, there's a lot there to unpack, but basically, that's an example of the regulatory state that sort of operates under its own rules, really operates outside of the constitutional system that was originally set up, like the framework for government.
Yeah, normally under the constitutional system that was set up, when you have a problem with the government or the government has a problem with you, both of you go before a neutral judge that fairly adjudicates your case. In the modern administrative system, however, the agency selects who that judge is and can remove that judge and replace them. And so in a system like that, the agency is going to select those individuals most likely to rule in its favor, and it's going to remove those individuals that don't rule in its favor. There's nothing mysterious about why the FTC wins all the time.
So there's this tension that exists between Congress and the regulatory state. Maybe tension isn't really the right word. The regulatory state pretty much gets to do whatever it wants. One of the things you guys propose here, though, and maybe the central feature to this entire idea, is having Congress sort of assert itself a bit more. Give me like a concrete example, if you can, of like what that would look like. How should Congress go about, or how could Congress go about doing that?
There's a bunch of stuff that's like in proposal or has been proposed or discussed among the Ministry of State. Big things like the FTC banning non-disclosure agreements, or it was raised not that long ago that they were thinking about banning gas stoves. Things like that are just, I think, directly contrary to what the public wants, and that they're thinking about doing it anyway. And if Congress gets a vote on these kind of measures, most of them are never going to get through Congress. And those that do get through Congress that are contrary to what the people want, those congressmen aren't going to be congressmen for very much longer. And so the way this works is we require all of the rules. We start out as only two agencies, but we require all of the rulemaking to start in Congress. That Congress debates about it, Congress votes about it, and if Congress agrees on what should happen, that is the only thing that can be implemented. If there's a disagreement between the House and the Senate, we have a fallback allowing the President to either choose the one that gets the most votes in the House or the version that gets the most votes in the Senate. So there will be something that comes out of this process, but it ensures that the first step starts with the people's representatives actually making votes.
Yeah, that seems really important too, and that really is fundamental to like democratic government, right? That the people who are making the rules are ultimately the people elected and who can be defeated in future elections by the people if they don't like the way it goes. That doesn't happen, of course, in the regulatory state. We're talking with Devin Watkins. He's an attorney at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, talking about their new report. You can find it at CEI.org. Constitutional Restoration is the title, How to Rebuild the Separation of Powers. Devin, not a lot of time left here, but before I let you go, I did want to touch on one other thing in here, because we often think about this constitutional restoration type project as being exactly what we were just talking about, this tug of war between Congress and the regulatory state. There's also an element here of judicial reform that you guys highlight, and I think that's significant. So tell us what you would do there.
Yeah, so as we were talking about with the FTC winning basically every case that they bring before administrative law judges, either directly or on appeal to themselves, instead, we replace those administrative law judges that are selected by the agency and replace them with kind of federal magistrates that are selected by circuit courts. This ensures that it is Article III judges that appoint, and these ALJs are accountable to those Article III judges, that have lifetime appointments, and that don't have any influence from any kind of political forces. They are the epitome of fairness, and we think that's a lot better than having the ALJs selected by the agency.
Yeah, there you go. More independent judges. That makes a lot of sense. Congress writing the rules rather than the regulatory state. That makes a lot of sense, too. There's more in the report. We don't have time to get to it today, but Devin, thanks for taking some time with us.
Thank you.
And again, that's Devin Watkins. He's an attorney at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Check out all of their fine work online at CEI.org, including that new report on constitutional restoration. And like perfect timing for this, really. I mean, this is the project of the 4th of July, and it's a project that I think continues today, maybe is even more essential today than it has been in a long time. So check that out online. Head on over to Reason.com to check out everything we're working on this week. And for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Russian President Vladimir Putin and Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko share a love of nuclear weapons. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College talks about the danger on this American Radio Journal commentary.
As the summer of 2023 continues, with a very fluid and potentially dangerous situation evolving in Vladimir Putin's Russia, here's a man you should know and keep your eyes on. His name is Alexander Lukashenko. Lukashenko is a Belarusian buddy of Vladimir Putin. You may have heard his name in the news recently as he tried to broker a deal between Putin and the head of the Wagner group that recently started an insurrection against Putin. Lukashenko has held the presidency of Belarus, the former Soviet republic, since the office was established after the breakup of the Soviet Union. He took the helm in July 1994, making him the longest-serving leader in all of Europe. In fact, that's even longer than Putin has held the sword at the Kremlin. Putin took over in the year 2000. In a November 2012 interview with Reuters, Lukashenko actually referred to himself as, quote, the last dictator in Europe, unquote. And so he is. And he said that over 10 years ago. How, well, Soviet-like? Could it be any other way for this politician who rose through the ranks of Komsomol, the Soviet Young Communist League, a collectivist farm in the Red Army where he was a political officer? Luki was a good commie, and now he's Putin's pal. Together, they have blown past elections in their respective countries, ensconced themselves as authoritarian leaders, and now have forged a united front against Ukraine. More than that, the latest, quite alarmingly, is their coming together on Russian nukes. At 6'2 and over 200 pounds, Lukashenko might dominate Putin in pictures, with little Vlad almost looking like his puppet boy, but the opposite is true. Mad Dog Putin has Lukashenko licking from his paw. And in a quite scary development, that includes the Putin hand that holds the nuclear codes. A few months ago, it was disclosed that Putin and Lukashenko had reached an agreement to deploy Russian nukes in Belarus this summer to counter what they called the threat posed by the independent democratic country that Putin roared into with his tanks in February 2022. That would be Ukraine. Ever since, the Russians, characteristic of their usual performance in combat, have gotten their tails kicked into Ukraine. I've commented here previously for American Radio Journal that that's hardly a surprise. That is what Russians do in battle. They get their butts kicked. Unfortunately, in the case of Putin's Russia, that could portend something actually worse, which I've warned about for over a year, namely that Putin might get so desperate over his military's predictable failures that he resorts to using nuclear weapons against Ukraine, but only as a defensive measure, you see, such is precisely what Putin's puppet from Belarus said a few weeks ago. Lukashenko said in mid-June that he would, quote, not hesitate, unquote, to use nukes against an aggressor country, no doubt with the aggressor Ukraine in mind. He said, quote, I believe it is unlikely that anyone would want to wage war against a country that has such weapons. It is a weapon of deterrence. God forbid if I have to make a decision to use this weapon in modern times. But I won't hesitate should there be an aggression against us. No doubt thinking of Zelensky's Ukraine, Lukashenko said that he did not want to see, quote, not a single, and here he used the B word, set foot on Belarusian soil. Should such persons do so, quote, the response will be immediate, unquote. And so, like Vladimir Putin, Lukashenko is now talking nukes, but only defensively, of course. Should such a prospect of deterrence become necessary, that's when he might use them. Poor Belarus. Poor Russia. How awful to be right next door to that vicious country called Ukraine. As for the rest of the world, where does this leave us? Well, we watch and wait, hoping that little Vlad and his big Belarusian buddy don't use those nukes that they're now coveting together. We shall see. As for me, count me as remaining very pessimistic. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WBSS-AM in Linwood, New Jersey, WJXY-FM in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, along with WYAY-FM in Wilmington, North Carolina. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.